Hi, and welcome to this Microsoft Virtual Academy session. My name is Chris Rhodes, and I'm a Microsoft Certified Trainer, and I'm an awardee of the MVP Award. And I'm here to tell you today all about the 697 exam, which is configuring Windows devices. What we're aiming to show you through this session here is how to get you ready for the exam, how to make sure that you're at that point where you're ready to book the exam, or maybe not, maybe to wind back a little bit and to see what else you need to do to study to get yourself to that place where you're ready to go ahead and feel confident about booking the exam. So what I'm going to be doing with you today is to explain a little bit about the exam, and then to go and talk through the exam objective domain in quite some detail, explaining each section and what's required of you in each of the exam OD areas. First of all, let's just put this into context and have a look at where does this exam sit in the big overall scheme of things. The 697 exam is one of many exams you can do around Windows, but it's probably the first one you're going to do for Windows 10. It stands as a standalone test and will earn you the Microsoft Specialist certification in Windows configuration. So we can take this and use it as it is and put that on your resume or on your CV, or you can actually build this forwards and take it forward to the MCSE level and combine it with the 695 and the 696 exams. Now, there are separate sessions we've already got covering those on MVA, so please go and check those out. There's two parts in the further series that explains more detail about the 695, 696 MCSA. Today, we're focusing on that Microsoft Specialist exam, hoping to get you to that level so you're ready to take that test. When we look on Microsoft.com/learning and we look up the 697 exam, there's a webpage that tells us what skills are being measured on this test. And this is something that I would definitely encourage you to go and have a look at, because it explains in quite some detail what areas, what OD areas we call them, or functional groups, are being tested in that test. And you'll want to make sure that you spend some time going through them all and checking them off to make sure that you're confident and you're happy to proceed with the exam, knowing that you've gone through all of those areas and that you've studied and read well before you go ahead. And my goal today is to try and shove you along that little bit and to show any little missing gaps that you might be lacking in your knowledge, so that you're feeling a little bit more proficient in those areas. Now, the exam skills measured area is broken down into 9 sections. They're roughly equally weighted. So we're looking at about 11, 12, 13% on each of those 9 areas. So you want to study them equally, not spending too much time in one area, not enough in the others. You want to spread your revision time and your study time out really equally amongst all of those topic areas. So what I'm going to do really here is to drill down a little bit more for you in each of those 9 areas, starting with managing identity. So today's modern world, where Windows 10 is likely to operate and other Windows devices is likely to operate, is very much part of that cloud-orientated world, but also is likely to be part of an on-premises world as well. So one of the things we're asking you guys to be up to speed on is that you know a lot about authorization and authentication, not just on your own network, and there's lots of different ways to do that in a corporate network, but also to have the knowledge of how Windows 10 operates on a home network, in a work group. So you really need to have a spread of skills that are taking you from just maybe working at home on your own or out in the field, so working in an enterprise network where you've got that knowledge about how to join the domain or how to workplace join the machine as well. Lots of people have experience about domain joining a computer. That's nothing new. But there's a lot of new technologies out in Windows 10, and we're around in Windows 8.1 as well, that are looking at some of the newer areas, such as workplace join. So you really need to know about, how do I interact from outside of the four walls of the company? How do I connect over the internet? And how do I join in and participate and register my device instead of necessarily joining it to the domain, but to register it to Active Directory so it can be controlled by the administrator and we can interact a little bit more than just being out in the field disconnected. And one area that's really changed quite a bit in Windows 10 is authentication. So there's a lot of new tech under the hood. Take a look at things like Windows Hello, for example. Windows Hello gives you the opportunity to authenticate not with a username or a password, but using biometric information. And this is an area that I'm seeing a lot of growth in right now. People are looking at devices that will use either fingerprint or facial recognition, for example, to log them into their device. We already have devices on the market that will do that. we also need to have an awareness of how a Windows device will sit into the world of the cloud. Now, this could be Azure AD, joining to an Azure AD environment, but also accessing applications and store resources. So we need to know a little bit about how we might do that using a workplace account, using a corporate account, but also using a Microsoft account. So you need to have exposure and experience in doing both of those things, operating perhaps as an individual, consuming resources as a Microsoft account user, but also accessing things with a corporate user account as well. So we often ask questions around sideloading, authentication, accessing stores. Yeah. So make sure you've had a good old play around with those things. And let's take a look at a question that relates to that. So in this question here, we're looking at a company's four different types of hardware asset. They have four different types of laptop configuration. All of them are Windows 10 compatible, so they will definitely run Windows 10, but they have some specific hardware features. The first laptop comes with a smart card reader and a TPM chip. The second laptop has a fingerprint reader and a TPM chip. The third, a smart card reader and an integral webcam. And the last one has an illuminated infrared camera and a TPM chip. And the question here is, which two of those hardware types will support specifically the Windows Hello feature for authentication? Now, there are some potential answers here that if you're unqualified and you don't know the material very well, can catch you out. For example, TPM. TPM is great for many, many things, and it's absolutely brilliant to have a TPM chip in your machine these days for various reasons, but that's not a requirement for Hello. Okay? Smart cards also not a requirement for Hello. So in fact, our correct answer here is looking at devices that either have a fingerprint reader or that have that facial recognition hardware that's described here as an illuminated infrared camera. That's different to a webcam. The type of camera you usually have on a traditional laptop is not the same thing. This is a specific new generation of hardware that will detect your face either in the light or in the dark, and that's what it's an infrared camera. Okay. Whether it comes in conjunction with TPM is somewhat irrelevant. The thing we're looking for here is that you know that Windows Hello as a feature requires either fingerprint camera or indeed some other third-party piece of biometric as well. So the takeaway here is know your authentication types, know what's required in each case. The same could be true if we were looking for a question to do with smart cards. Smart cards use certificates, you need a smart card reader, either locally installed or USB attached to your device to be able to authenticate that way, rather than a traditional username and password, which we're trying to move away from in the modern world. The second OD area I want to talk to here is looking at how we plan desktop and device deployment. Now, this covers a big area. There's a lot of text on screen. I'm not intentionally reading every single part out. You can download these slides and read this up later, or you can have a look at the skills measured on this 697 webpage yourself. I don't want to read every single word out here. But specifically, you need to know about when we're deploying Windows machines to people, what tasks might we be doing as an admin to ensure a smooth delivery to the end users? And part of that is making sure that we can migrate the user data successfully. So we need to have exposure to tools like USMT, User State Migration Tool. So you need to know about scan state, load state, and all the different ways it can be used, including things like hard link migration stores, as well as copying data off to a file server on your network and bringing it back in again. You also need to know about things like user profiles, how they can be set up and managed. In a large corporate environment, these are often managed so that users cannot interact so well with them, they may be read-only, like a mandatory profile. So you need to know how to set those up and what's required for that. We're also looking here at Hyper-V. Hyper-V and having a hypervisor on your machine isn't for everybody. It's most often used for IT professionals, developers, who want to really experiment with virtual machines. But the hypervisor role is increasingly important in Windows. But this particular part is measuring us on how do we set up Hyper-V on a machine? What are the hardware requirements? What kind of machine do I need to be able to install and use Hyper-V? Because it does come as part of Windows these days, but it's just not installed by default. So there are some specific hardware requirements around that. But you also need to know about, okay, so what if I want to build out some virtual machines? We need to know about generation 1, generation 2 machines. what operating systems are supported in each case there. So for example, generation two is Windows 8.1 and onwards guest operating systems. But you also need to know things like how to network them. Suppose I've got some virtual machines. How do I get machine A to talk to machine B? How do I get machine B to talk to the internet? You need to know how to set up the different types of network switches here and configure those for virtual machines. Now, but some of the tasks like this, we wouldn't always expect that you just only knew how to do that through the GUI. One theme that's going to run throughout this whole exam here is your ability to use whichever tool. Now, that could be a command line tool, a GUI tool, could even be PowerShell. Now, PowerShell is very rich within Windows 10 these days. It's grown massively in the last 3 or 4 years in Windows. So I'd also reach out to you and say, look, sure, if you know how to do that through the GUI, great. Do you also know how to do that through PowerShell? If not, make a point of finding out and looking for those parallels as to how do I accomplish that task in PowerShell? Because why? Because maybe I need to configure that on 100 machines consistently or 1,000 machines in my network. How do I go about writing a PowerShell script that would go and deliver that same setting? It's not good enough just to know only how to do things through a GUI. And Hyper-V is just one example of that. And we'll see more as we go through. The next subsection here is mobility. More often than not, when new Windows devices are provisioned, they're mobile devices. So they're going to be laptops, tablets. Of course, Windows 10 is also available for phones as well. But specifically here, we're looking at your laptop or your tablet user here, and some of the features that might be required to support those, such as Windows To Go. Okay, you should know that Windows Enterprise is required to be able to use Windows To Go, and you can provision a USB stick with a Windows To Go image, so you can carry that around and have Windows on a memory stick. You can plug into any computer, power it up, and go and use it. You've got to know how to provision that, how to care for it, and also how to secure it with things like BitLocker. In terms of other features, there's a whole bunch of settings around things like Wi-Fi, connecting to wireless networks, managing those wireless networks on behalf of users. So you're going to see also areas reaching out into group policy, which includes things like wireless control, for example. Maybe sometimes we're configuring wireless as an individual, so we need to know how to do that through, let's say, the Settings app in Windows 10, but we also need to know how to configure that as if we were doing it for 1,000 PCs in a group policy. So again, make sure you know the different scales of that, and we're not just looking at can you configure it once on a single computer. Would you be able to do that for 1,000 computers in just as much time as well using PowerShell, group policy, or whatever's relevant? So in this case, group policy. A few other areas I want to call out here. BitLocker. Most organizations deploying Windows nowadays on mobile devices are going to be using BitLocker to protect the operating system drive and or data drives as well. So we take it as read that you guys know how to provision that. You also know about the group policy settings that go with that, but also how to provision that at deployment time and some of the settings that go with that, such as unlocks. So let's take a look at a sample question that's concerned with just that. So, you purchase several new devices that will run Windows 10 Enterprise and that require the operating system drive to be encrypted. The new devices contain a TPM 1.2 chip, so you need to ensure that the Windows 10 devices can start successfully without requiring a PIN or a password when they're connected to the corporate network. Which group policy setting should you configure? Now, all of the four choices here in this particular question are all perfectly valid. They're not made up. Okay, the exam questions are always that way. They don't make up answers. But only one of them is going to achieve the goal here in this case. So the correct answer here is to allow for network unlock. This is a feature where if your PC is detected as being on the corporate network, it can reach out, unlock itself automatically. We don't require user input for that. If they're away from the network, it behaves slightly differently. Now, if you didn't know that, please review the group policy settings. There's about 3 or 4 different subsections within group policy that describe BitLocker behavior. So there's BitLocker for data drives, BitLocker for operating system drives and removable drives. There's about 3 or 4 different sections. I would definitely strongly urge you to look through those so you know what they all do. So in the case of this particular question here, I would expect you to know all of those and what they do so that you can pick the correct one out. Okay, so it's worth spending some time looking at the server side, the group policy side in this case, as well as knowing how to configure things on your client machine. Okay, so in the case of BitLocker, I would expect you to know how to configure that maybe through the GUI and control panel, but that's low-hanging fruit. I'd also expect you to know how to do that from PowerShell or from command line and also through group policy as well. So let's move on to our next OD area. This is planning and implementing Microsoft Intune as a device management solution. Now, I recognize that Intune isn't used by everybody, but you need to know how it works and the scenarios it would be useful to use it in to support your mobile devices. This area is getting bigger and bigger. More people are using this, and it's not just the small and medium-sized companies. In fact, there's a lot of large companies using this to supplement what they already use on their corporate network with tools like Configuration Manager. So you really do need to have practiced quite a bit with Intune. And the way I normally recommend people practice with that is to set up a virtual machine or a couple of virtual machines. Create a trial subscription account to Intune, which is free to do, and will give you 30 days to play around with that as much as you want. You can enroll your virtual machines to Intune and control them and pretend that those are real mobile computers and play around with them, sending down policies to them, downloading applications to them, and more. So this particular part of the exam really assumes that you've had some hands-on with that. And there is no other way. It's a cloud-based service. You have to be using a subscription to test that. Okay? You cannot just use a virtual machine in isolation. You have to have a physical or a virtual machine connect to the internet, work with that service. You need to manage that service through the Intune portal and see how those things work together. So let's take a look at an example question around Intune. You have several mobile devices that run Windows 10. The mobile devices are managed by using an Intune subscription. You plan to deploy a new Microsoft Exchange server that will be accessed by the Windows 10 devices. The server will use certificates issued by a new certification authority, or CA, that you manage. You need to ensure that the Windows 10 devices can access the Exchange server without prompting with a certificate warning message. Which type of policy should you create in Intune? Now, don't be confused here. The question is about what type of policy do I deploy in Intune in order to roll out a new certificate authority certificate. Okay? If your brain was thinking, oh, Exchange server, that's to do with, you know, server certificates, you're thinking the wrong way here. The Exchange server is an example of a service that uses certificates. The question is about, how do I make sure my Windows 10 computers trust the CA that the Exchange server's certificate came from? It's really nothing to do with the Exchange server. It's to do with making sure they trust the CA itself. So the correct answer here is a configuration policy, not an Exchange policy, and so on. This is a configuration policy, and there are lots of different variations of configuration policies. You need to look through those. There's probably about a dozen or more different types of configuration policies, but there is one specifically for this scenario where you can deploy a certificate that you've uploaded into the Intune portal, and you can have that download onto your devices automatically once they're managed by Intune. So again, play with the product. Look through them all. I'm not saying you necessarily have time and energy to look through and test every single one of these policies, but you should be aware at least of what the policies are and what task each of them performs so that you can make the right choice about which one you're going to be using. Now, let's move on to one of my favorite areas, configuring networking. I say this is one of my favorite areas because, you know what, some things in here haven't changed that much over the years. A TCP/IP version 4 address is pretty much unchanged in the last 10 or 15 years, but that's not the whole story. There's a lot of new technology even here that's been around only in the last couple of Windows versions. So just to pick out a couple of things here, location-aware printing. This ability to be able to determine on a client machine whereabouts that is in the world at any given point in time. Am I currently in Office A or am I in Office B? If I'm in Office A, I want to be able to use the default printer that's found in Office A. And when I automatically pop up my machine onto the Office B network, I want to make sure I'm using the relevant printer there as well. So how do we do that? We configure location-aware printing. Have you done that before? If you haven't, try it out. Now, that's one of the more straightforward things that you can test that doesn't take that much time and effort, but I often find people have never taken the time out to actually try that. Okay, so you definitely want to have a test set up here. What I would recommend is build out some virtual machines. In fact, use Hyper-V that we talked about earlier on a Windows 10 machine. That way you'll learn both at the same time. You're learning how Hyper-V works, but you're also using that to build yourself some test virtual machines that you can then go and configure this on without damaging any proper production machines as well. Wireless networking is really important here. Lots of people have issues connecting to Wi-Fi. There's lots of different standards involved. There's lots of different types of authentication involved. And again, you should know how to build that out through group policy so you can automate the rollout of those settings to dozens of machines. I'm not expecting for a, let's say, a 500 PC organization, I wouldn't expect you as the tech guy to walk around to every single one of those machines and configure its Wi-Fi settings. No, I'd expect you to deploy that through a group policy. But equally, you may need to troubleshoot that on an individual user's PC one at a time sometimes as well. So again, you've got to know the GUI. You've got to know how to do it from command line locally. But you've also got to know how to roll that out to thousands of machines using tools like group policy to achieve that. So we'll have a look at a question in just a minute or two that relates to that, in fact. One other area here is configuring security. Now, this is quite broad. We're looking at things like the firewall. We're looking at network discovery. And I often find people don't really quite get some of the areas like network discovery, partly because some of that is almost taken away from you. It's all about choosing the right network when you first connect to it. I don't know if you've seen that before, but when you connect to a new network, it usually pops up and says, would you like to, there's like a yes, no button. Would you like to use printers and resources on this network, something along those lines? And you can say yes or no. And that's really saying, are you enabling discovery? Okay. And it's also putting the firewall into a different mode. Your answer to that question is determining, well, basically, are we on a public network or are we on a trusted network? So various things happen behind the scenes there, but you can interact with that to some extent. And we're calling out here, for example, the firewall and firewall exceptions. So I'd expect you to know not just how to build out firewall rules in Control Panel. You should know that. That's the low-hanging fruit. But you should also know how to build those out in Windows Firewall with advanced security. And again, in group policy. Sorry to keep saying those words. Because it can be done in several ways. You can also do that from the command line too. So what I want to look at here briefly is a question that relates to the command line. So let's have a look. This one's to do with wireless. You must troubleshoot a device that runs Windows 10. The device fails to connect to the wireless network that is maintained by your company, but other devices connect successfully to that network. You suspect that the device is located in a part of the building that has poor wireless coverage. You need to verify whether the device can locate the wireless network. So how would we do that from a command line? That's the challenge. Many of us would look at the signal strength in the GUI, but that's not what this question is about. This is saying, what would you type from a diagnostics point of view? How would you see which networks were in range and the signal strength of each of those in turn? And this really brings me onto one of my favorite command line tools because it's so versatile. But at the same time, it does catch people out because it can do so much. But yet, I often find it's not used as very widely as it could be by IT professionals. So it's one that you want to get very familiar with. We can accomplish lots of things with NetSH. So I'm going to go and have a look at that on screen with you. So I've taken one of the answer choices here. Incidentally, it's not the correct one. But I've taken this here just to give you a quick heads up on how this might work. Now, NetSH has various different subcontexts. In this case, we're in the WLAN or wireless network area. And then we're proceeding on to use the show networks command to show what wireless networks are available. In this case, we don't see any, okay? Either because we don't have a wireless network adapter enabled or we just don't have one at all on this particular machine. But that's not the point, okay? the command did compute successfully. Let's take a look at what the right answer is, however. All of the answer choices on this screen here are all perfectly valid, regular commands that you could run, but which one is the correct answer in this case? Oh, I beg your pardon, it is the correct answer. I don't know why I said it wasn't. I was thinking of another one. So in this case, show networks is the one to display the networks that are in range of this machine and the relative signal strength. Now that doesn't mean I can definitely connect to it, but if I can't see it, if the signal strength is not good enough and I just don't even see it on my radar, so to speak, then I can't connect, okay? Equally, seeing it doesn't mean you can connect or obtain an IP address, but this question is really about how do you get a diagnostics on an individual machine about what they can actually see, what's in range, and that would show you that. So play with that, and again, I would urge you to play with all the other answer choices here as well, so you get some familiarity about what can be accomplished. NetSH is not just about wireless networks, folks. You can do the firewall with that. You can do many things with it. It's one of those I'd recommend that you probably look up on TechNet, in fact, because it's so vast. It can accomplish so many things. When I tell people, when I'm teaching a class, did you know you could do that in NetSH? They're like, no, I had no idea. I've always done it through the GUI. Okay, fine, but stretch yourself. Find out what else NetSH can do, because you might find that you might be reaching for that in the future when you're building machines and automating. So as a key takeaway here, understand your command line tools. And I don't just mean your good old-fashioned ipconfig, ping, sure. But there's a depth of tools out there that a lot of people don't come across, and that's just one of them. Okay, next up, we're going to have a look at configuring storage. For some people, they don't get involved to this level. They might get involved in storage to the point that when they're installing Windows, they're selecting the drive and maybe formatting that drive as part of that process, but that might be as far as they go. But that's not good enough. We need you to know more across not just the depth, but the breadth here too. So we're looking at, can you configure OneDrive and the nuances with that? So for example, you need a Microsoft account to sign into Windows first. You need to know how OneDrive works, both the desktop app, the modern app, how it works in the cloud also, so that you know how to, for example, I don't know, undelete files that you deleted from your local hard drive and got synced up as a delete to the cloud. You need to know that, hey, you can actually get that back. There's a recycle bin in the cloud in your OneDrive account that you can actually retrieve files back, okay? If you didn't know that, you're welcome. We also need to know how to configure some local services here with storage. So for example, storage spaces. Now, I know we've covered this on MVA courses before, but probably more on server, because storage spaces is one of those things that a lot of people associate with you know, Windows Server, building out RAID arrays and things like that. But that's actually in box here on Windows as well. So why would you want to do that? A lot of people I know are enthusiasts. They depend on locally stored data, maybe as well as using OneDrive. You want to provide some fault tolerance. How do you do that? We do that these days through storage spaces. We combine drives together into virtual disks. And with those virtual disks, we can build out different types of disk. Now, those might be thin provisioned or not. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, please research and play with that. And you need to have some exposure to that. One of the best ways I would learn that is, again, virtualization. Get a virtual machine. Install Windows into it. Then add some more virtual hard disks into that virtual machine. And then suddenly you're lighting up a whole bunch of disks that you can then play with and build up storage spaces with. And you can play with those, break them, play with them, break them. So you can experiment with all the different things that you can do there. A lot of that, pardon the pun, mirrors what you can accomplish on Windows Server. Okay, so we have MVA content that goes specifically into that, but play with it on your local machine. Like I say, set up some virtual hard drives, add them in. And by the way, make sure you know the difference between a virtual hard drive and a virtual disk. A virtual disk is something we do in a storage space. Okay? A virtual hard drive is something we can just natively add into Windows. We can mount it in Windows. We can use it in virtual machines. We could even use them inside of storage spaces. But a virtual disk is something that we create out of a storage space. And that could be using physical disks only, or virtual hard disks, or a blend. Now, data security. This is quite a broad area. And there's so many parts to this. We've already mentioned BitLocker a while ago, so I don't want to repeat myself too much, except to call out MBAM. All right, make sure you've played with some of the MDOP tools. MBAM comes from Microsoft Desktop Optimization Pack, MDOP. So please get a hold of that and play with that. If you can't get a hold of that, there is an MVA course that explains that, so go watch that. But let's call out a few areas we haven't looked at. And here are some of the bread and butter technologies here, NTFS and permissions. I know so many people that think they know that, but don't. And you throw them a question, and so many people fall down. Some of the basics, you just got to know. You need to know how to make shares. You need to know how to configure NTFS folder and file level security to secure your data, and also how those two overlay. So if I'm sharing a folder to users on my network, and it's also secured with NTFS, how do those permissions work together? Well, the quick answer is the most restrictive applies. But there's a lot more depth to that. Also, know how EFS works. It's not used every day by all organizations, but some users use that, especially on mobile computers, where they need to protect the integrity of the corporate data. You've got to know how EFS works and the whole life cycle of that. So for example, you need to know how to provision it, how to be able to decrypt things if a user loses their certificate as well, and how to share access to other users so that two or three people can access encrypted files, whereas natively that would only work for one person. Let's take a look at an example question that goes into that in a bit more detail. So this question I've picked out is to do with storage spaces. You install Windows 10 on a desktop computer that has 4 1-terabyte hard drives. One of the drives contains the operating system. The other disks have never been used and they're unpartitioned. Okay. You need to configure a two-way mirror to protect your data and use the maximum amount of space available. So for a lot of people here, that's new language. Many people have never heard of a two-way mirror. Okay, the modern Windows operating systems now refer to things like RAID 1 and RAID 5 in different ways now. So make sure you know your language and your terminology there. Straight away, that catches folk out if they haven't played with the tech in front of them. Okay, so go in and create a storage space and then have a look at what you can do with that once you've created it. And that will help to explain what we're talking about here. Anyway, back to the question. So the question is, what size storage space should you configure? And again, just to reiterate the previous line, using the maximum amount of space available. So can we include our operating system drive here? No, we don't want to do that. We want to leave that alone. We don't want to create a mirror for our data that includes the operating system drive. We want to keep that apart. So some of you might be thinking, okay, so that gives me 3 terabytes left. I don't see an answer choice for 3 terabytes. Ah, but wait, this is a mirror. So how much space is that mirror going to give me if I create a mirror? Well, it's not 1.5 terabytes. The correct answer here is 4. And the nuance with that one is you need to know about thin provisioning, okay? It's not as straightforward as you may have expected, because we could use the exact space that's available to us only, or we can thin provision, meaning that it doesn't stop me creating spaces that are bigger than that, as long as I add space later on by putting drives in at a later time. There are limits, but it's effectively limitless. You don't have to be constrained with what you've actually got physically attached to the machine today. You can provision space later and add that in without needing to reconfigure the drives and the drive letters and so forth at a later time, okay? So the key phrase there was using the maximum available space that you can do. Now, 4 terabytes isn't the maximum you can do, but it's the highest on offer, so that's the one you need to have picked. Again, know your storage spaces, know about virtual disks, and so on. Okay, so our next OD area to look at here is managing data access and protection. We have two areas here, configuring shared resources and then configuring folder and file access too. Now, let's take a look at the top one first. Some of that we talked about on the previous slides, looking at managing shared folders. But again, do you know how to do that? There's probably 3, 4, 5, 6 different ways you can accomplish that task in the GUI and PowerShell. I won't bore you to death with that now. But home groups catch people out. a lot of people only have support experience of using Windows in a corporate environment. Fair play, but here we're also asking you to know how it works in a home group environment too, because you might want to share data to another computer in your house. Maybe you've got a bunch of music files on one computer and you want to be able to stream those to another device in your house. That could be another Windows device or your TV or some other media box. So things like libraries help us with that. So you've got to know about library sharing, how to turn that on, the different options that you have for creating and joining home groups, and the different levels of sharing that you can achieve, both in the home group scenario, but also back out in the corporate world, in the classic folder sharing scenarios as well. And we'll have a look at a question in a moment that talks about that, but let's take a look at file and folder access. So again, we're back to some of my favorites. We're looking at encryption. We're looking at NTFS security. Okay, so you need to be proficient in that. And the best way to do that is to practice and play and break it. Set up a couple of test users. Play around with things like denying permissions to them. Play around with groups, adding groups, assigning permissions, so that you can really truly understand how those work together. Okay. Let's go to that question. You have three computers that run Windows 10 and are in a home group. One of the computers has a folder located at /photos. Currently, the two other computers cannot access that folder. You need to ensure that the users on the other two computers can access data in the folder. What should you do? Okay. So we could potentially create a shared folder. But that's not one of our choices here. That would get it done, but that's not on offer. My mind initially thinks, well, I could just share that, set the relevant permissions, create it as a shared folder. That could work, but again, not an option. So what are the options? Well, we could pin photos to quick access. That's not going to get it shared. Quick access is an area in Windows 10 that shows you your sort of frequently used, most recently used documents. It's an awesome feature, but it's nothing to do with sharing, and it won't help me get that to other users on my network. Should I turn on network discovery for the guest or public network? No, absolutely not. We never do that. That would be crazy. Turning on discovery means that if I'm connected to a public network, such as in a coffee shop, people might be able to see my resources that I'm sharing. I never want to do that. It's acceptable to turn on discovery on trusted networks, such as a home network. We've already told you this is in a home group. Read between the lines, okay? We've already got a computer that's in a home group. It's already on a trusted network, so that doesn't apply. We don't want to do anything that's related to guest or public networks. So that also turns out that C is not an option for us as well. So the only real possible answer and the correct answer here is to actually add the photos folder to the pictures library. So understand about library sharing. You can add other folders to your standard library folders. You'll be familiar with those, you know, documents, videos, music. Okay, these are standard folders that when you're in a home group, you can elect to share those. Not necessarily all of them, but you can share those out. If you've got a folder that's got content that isn't part of those standard folders anyway, it is possible for you to add that to a library, and therefore it makes it available. So if you've shared, in this case, the pictures, I think it's called, library, then this would automatically bring that C:/photos into view as well. Okay, so we don't need to make a file share. We can use the library sharing techniques in a home group to accomplish that. Okay, let's move on to remote access. And this brings up a whole world of technologies and acronyms and authentication methods that can bewilder. So I'll try and keep it simple. Remote authentication is different to regular LAN-based authentication. So for example, on a LAN, connecting to my domain controller, I'm going to be using Kerberos to authenticate me. Not so much if I'm working away from the office. If I'm out in the field and I need to connect in, say, via VPN, we cannot use Kerberos. But we can use other methods. Find out what they are. I'm not going to list them all out for you here and do all your homework for you, but find out. There's quite a few. I'll give you a clue. MS Chat version 2, and there's others like that. Find out the pros and cons of each of those and when they would be used. When would I use this over this? Protected eApp is another one, for example. smart cards. Know the differences, know when you can use them, and also what else is required to make that happen. So if I'm saying smart cards, you need certificates. If you're getting certificates, you need a certificate authority, and so on. We also need to know about a few of the newer features in the modern Windows client operating systems, such as VPN Reconnect. That's quite a new thing. We can use that with IKE tunnels. And that's not the same as Direct Access, by the way. Whole different ball game. It's similar, but IKE tunnels and PPTP tunnels and L2TP tunnels are all types of VPN that a user might launch. You've also got to know a bit about Direct Access and how that works, which is a computer-initiated method of connecting to your network in an always-on sense. There's requirements for that. There's infrastructure needed for that. There's configuration needed on the client machine for that too, but that's usually group policy driven. Find out about Direct Access. We've got some MVA content on that actually. Okay, coming back to mobility. Again, a little bit of overlap here. Windows to Go came up earlier, but let's pick on a few other bits. Offline files. Offline files is something that's been around for ages. Have you configured it? Do you know how that works? Can you control it on and off in GPO? Would you know where to look? Okay, find out. Power policies, that's getting a lot more airtime than it used to because all of us are now using mobile computing platforms, laptops, tablets, a lot more than ever before. And what are we interested in there? Battery life, performance. So even though some of those things have been around for years and years, I'm finding I'm using those a lot more and there's a more depth to those too. So I'm not just talking about turn your monitor off after 5 minutes of idle time, sure, part of that, but you've also got to know here about how do you create your own custom power policy and deploy that to all of your devices on your network so they all conform to the same? You could do that on a computer-by-computer basis or, sorry to sound like a stuck record here, but group policy. So let's take a look at a question that's in that area, not an area we've talked about, but let's take a look. You have a computer called Computer 1 that runs Windows 10. Computer 1 has 5 users, as described in the following table. You enable remote desktop on Computer 1. Which 2 users can establish a remote desktop connection to Computer 1? So we're calling out some default groups here. Okay, each of those 5 users belongs to one of the default groups in Windows. The question really is testing your knowledge on, suppose you go and turn on remote desktop. It's off by default, right? If you turn it on, who natively would be able to connect to that PC? Okay, now the question is which 2? One of those probably stands out as a pretty obvious one, I'm guessing. If you're looking at this, you're probably thinking administrators, right? Okay, which other? If you're doing the exam, you've got to get both of these right or it doesn't count. So let's take it as read administrators is the right answer. Which other is the correct answer as well? Turns out, remote management users. If you're not familiar with all of those groups, go away and study, okay? You're not ready for the test yet. Go back and look at those and see what empowerments they have. We don't always use administrators. Increasingly nowadays, we don't want people as admins on machines the whole time. We want them to be standard users or maybe to have a little bit more empowerment, okay? If I had a bunch of people who needed remote desktop access to this PC, I would not put them into administrators as a default option. I'd look to see which is the minimal group that I can put them in that gives them that ability to run that task, but nothing more. And in this case, remote management users fits that bill. The others, by the way, don't work. Okay, let's move on to managing apps. Now, there's a whole world of different types of apps these days that we've got to know about. I don't just mean desktop apps and modern apps. I'm talking here about remote apps. Now, remote apps are those served out by your remote desktop services infrastructure or from Azure. Azure now has remote app capabilities that mirrors that feature set that you traditionally find on a corporate network. Please make sure you've played with that. I'm going to do a demo on that in just a second, in fact, to show you what that's all about. Okay, but you've also got to know about both the on-premises and the cloud-based method of deploying applications using remote desktop, remote app as well. We've also got to know a lot about managing applications on a more local level, including things like deploying application fixes using ACT. If you've not come across that, that's part of the Windows Automated Deployment Kit, or ADK. Download that and play with that a lot. There's a lot of tools in ADK. ACT is just one of them. Going forwards, you guys should know more about that, because there's things like deployment tools, WinPE, USMT came up at the beginning, also part of the ADK as well. So let's take a look over. Oh, one other thing that catches my eye here is UEV. Now, I mentioned MDOP tools before. UEV is one of the MDOP tools, and it allows us to virtualize user settings. So for example, if a user is inside of an application and they tweak one of the settings, they then go to another computer, load up the same application, that setting can roam across without using roaming profiles or anything like that. It's a very lightweight way of making sure that we've got the same settings per app, per user, no matter which device they use. Maybe it's a VDI session today, an RDS session tomorrow, or a local computer the day after. Doesn't matter. With a UEV agent installed on all of those, we'll sync that for the user. So no matter which device they use, the experience is the same. Their preference that they configured in that app follows them around. If you've never used UEV, take some time out and learn it. It's well worth it. You might actually find you deploy it on your network. It's that good, actually. Now, let's switch over to Azure here. I'm just going to press F5 because I suspect this may have timed out since we started this little session here. Oh, no, I think we're still good. I've started to use this quite a bit to deploy applications. The reason is I use quite a lot of devices. There are certain applications I want to be able to use irrespective of which device I use. And I'm not even just talking here necessarily about Windows devices. What if I have an iOS device? Okay, a little bit off topic, but we can deploy remote apps that are consumed by all types of devices. The theme of this, of course, is Windows devices and configuring those, so let me get back to the point. So in here, inside of Azure, you can create app collections. An app collection is a bunch of applications together that you can allocate to bunches of users. So you can say, okay, my sales users, my sales group, I want them to have this app, this app, this app. My marketing users, I want them to have a different bunch of applications. So you can create these collections and decide who gets them. Oh, this one's disabled. Let's go and make a collection. This, in reality, takes quite a bit of time. We don't have time to sit and wait for that all to finish, but let's just see what that process would look like in creating an app collection. And I'm assuming here you've already got an Azure subscription. If you don't, go and get one. Okay, you can take one out for free, play with it for 30 days at no cost to yourself. So what I could do here is I could use the Office apps from the template choice, or I could use some standard Windows apps like, you know, Notepad, Calc, etc., from a standard Windows server image. You can upload your own as well. So if you want your own line of business apps, you can upload images that contain those and then point to that here. Okay, based on where I live in the world, I'm going to pick Northern Europe. Oops, I'm going to call this my app collection. Tell it to go and build that out. Oops, no spaces allowed. Let's try that. Oh, too long. My apps, let's try that instead. How's that? Okay, now that will take a little while to go and build out. But once I've done that, I can then select the applications I want to make available, who I want them to be available to, and I can either have them install a client tool, or I can publish those as shortcuts. There's different ways to make these available to people. The great thing about that is your apps are just maintained in one place. Now, we can do similar things on-prem. If you've got RDS infrastructure, you can do a very similar job there. In fact, of course, it's the same technology, isn't it? This is Windows Server, but in the cloud in this case. So if you don't have an RDS infrastructure in your office, okay, maybe look at Azure to supply that instead. So do we expect you to have played with that? Yes. If you haven't played with Azure, now there's a million and one things that Azure can do, but I'm calling out a couple of specific, you know, this is a specific area that you want some playtime with, okay? Azure Remote Apps. Even if you just use the standard stock ones like I was using there, you'll get a really good feel for it. And try that out in conjunction with a machine that signs into that to consume those applications. It won't take you that much time to learn, but you'll be glad you did. Right, so let's take a look at a question on that theme. Your company develops a 64-bit Windows line of business application for its customers. The applications are updated frequently. Tablet devices that run Windows, iOS, and Android must run the line of business applications. You need to recommend a solution that ensures that the applications can run on the tablets. The solution must minimize costs wherever possible. What should you recommend? So we could install the applications on Azure Virtual Machines. We could create an app collection in Azure Remote App. We could repackage and publish each application into the relevant app stores. So you could put it in the Windows Store, the Android Store, the iOS stores. Or you could create an app vpackage for each application. Now, straight away to me, one of these answers is definitely wrong. App v. To consume app v applications, you need a Windows client. So that immediately rules that out because we're trying to share the application to not just the Windows devices, but other platforms too. Could we install the applications on Azure Virtual Machines? We could, but spinning up virtual machines in Azure is a lot more expensive. Depending on how they're used and how long they're up for, there's more maintenance to that as well. So based on cost only, I'm going to rule that one out. It's not the most cost-efficient way of doing that. Your servers would have to be running all the time. Depending on the scale and how many users you've got, those might need to be quite powerful machines running in Azure. That could eat up your subscription money a lot quicker than if you were doing it through our correct answer here, which is remote app. Okay. Could we repackage and publish each application to the relevant store? You know what, you could do that, but it's going to take you way more time. So you're telling me that every time we update our application, we have to go through the process of uploading it to Apple's store, the Android store, and Windows store every time? That's too much maintenance. Update them to one place, available straight away to everybody, okay? Azure Remote App. Okay, our last area, stay with me guys, we're almost through this. Our last area here is managing updates and recovery. Really important stuff to learn here. The way that we manage our computers when they go wrong and preventing data loss if they go wrong, this is an area that's really important. And there's a ton of features here. I'm gonna just pick a few out here. File history. One of my favorite features in Windows that goes unsung. File history is a bit like, what's it called in Windows Server? I can't remember now. VSS, where you can actually have the ability to roll back previous file versions. You might have done that against the network file server. You can do that locally as well. So you can protect your local data using file history, using something like a local hard disk, USB hard disk, network share. Know how you configure that. That's really important. What else have we got here? Creating recovery drives. Make sure you know all the inbuilt tools to recover and the scenarios you use them in, okay? So, you know, I could configure a recovery drive. Is that the same as system restore? No. Is that the same as recovering a file? No. They all have their place. And one of the tricks here is to know, when do I invoke this, you know, A versus B versus C? When would I use system restore checkpoints to roll my system back to a healthy state versus recovering using a recovery drive? They're similar, but they're for different scenarios. Okay, there's some really good documentation on TechNet that describes those in much more detail than I have time for today. So go look that up, and again, play. Oh, refresh and recycle too. You know, this is built-in option in Windows now. If you're, let's say, handing your device over to somebody else in your company, and you want to wipe anything that was personal to you on there, you can refresh, you can reset that. There's a way to do that in Windows 10, which is pretty similar to 8.1. Play with both if you can. Okay, managing updates too. Windows updates are super important. You'll know that in Windows 10, it's a whole different mechanism for doing that now. You've got WSUS still, but moving forwards, computers that are not connected to corporate networks are going to want to go straight to the internet for their configuration so that they're always up to date. Enterprise computers will use things like long-term servicing branch. Now, But here we're more looking at Windows updates specifically and WSUS scenarios, but that could change in the future as things change with things like long-term servicing branch. That's still quite early days at this point in time. Know about also updating your store apps. Most of the time they do that by default, but that's controllable. Okay, so if I'm purchasing apps from the store, how do they get refreshed? How do they get updated? That can be manually, it's usually automatic. Know how you configure that. Okay, so one more question for you guys. You plan to ensure that you can recover previous versions of data files on a computer that runs Windows 10. You plug in a USB hard drive that you intend to use to store the previous versions, and you open File History and Control Panel. You need to ensure that the video files from your video's library are never protected using File History. Okay, so a little clue here that your library folders are protected by that by default. When you turn on File History, and then you can elect to choose other places too. But your library folders, again, like your music, your documents, your videos, they're covered automatically. We want to make sure that that never gets done. We never want our videos captured here. Why? Because they're probably quite big, and we don't want to sort of repeat that data onto our USB hard drive. It's probably the rationale behind that. So what do we do first? Well, do we select the USB drive? No. We don't. We exclude the folders first before we, as part of that preparation, as part of that configuration. So as you're selecting which library folders to include, or rather as you're provisioning, I beg your pardon, you exclude library folders. It includes all the libraries by default, but you can manually say, hey, I don't want that one. Exempt that one, please. It's too much data, or I already have copies, or I'm not likely. You know, if it's videos, you may be not working on them on a regular basis, like you would say Excel sheets and Word documents that are changing frequently. And that's why you want the previous version support for that, because you might edit a document and then want to go back. But this was saying videos, no. So exclude it first before or as part of the configuration for File History, so it never captures those and indexes them. Okay. We've walked through the objective domain. We've looked at the nine areas together. Maybe you're ready. Maybe you still need some help. So let me point you to some resources that I think will be quite useful for you in follow-up to what we've discussed today. The first one here is a Microsoft Press book, which is aimed specifically at folks like you who are preparing for the exam, and it's an exam ref guide, okay? It's not 3,000 pages thick, but it's quite intense. It covers all the exam objective domain areas that we've been talking about, but in way more detail than we had time to do today. It goes through and explains the technologies and how to use them, and some of the stuff I've been alluding to, it expands on. Okay, so take a look at that. If you want training, there are 2 5-day classes that you can take that will prepare you for the 697 exam. It's so big, the content, they had to split it into two. So there's 6971, 6972, both on version A at the time of talking to you today. Okay, so that is a lot of training, but Windows is a big technology. It contains lots of configuration and troubleshooting things. So the exam here is pretty broad. We already looked at the fact there's 9 objective domain areas. There's a lot here, right? You've got to be pretty good in all of those areas. So those two courses are great. If you've got the opportunity to do those, definitely attend those classes. If you don't, there are MVA content courses as well. Some of the key highlights I've got here for you, and you can get the links to these from the PowerPoint deck that you can download from MVA as well. So what's new in Windows 10? Well worth a look. So if you're new to Windows 10, you want to just find out a little bit more about what that's about. But some of the stuff for IT pros, the update for IT pros and the technical preview fundamentals, most of those fundamentals haven't changed, by the way. I know we're out of technical preview now. We're live with Windows 10, but most of that content is still bang on relevant. Well worth a look. But also having a look at Windows as a service, if you want to drill into the update stuff a little bit more. Maybe if you just want to get started, you haven't used Windows 10 much, start with the bottom one, okay? And then go back and watch some of the other ones as well. So a couple of things just to round off here about the exams. If you didn't already know, Microsoft have second shot enabled on their exams right now. So any exam you take between now and January the 12th, 2016, is eligible for second shot. So if you don't pass first time, hey, there's a safety net. You can have another go for no extra cost. So that might give you the confidence just to reach out and say, hey, you know what? I think I might be ready. I'm not entirely confident, but I'm 95% confident. We'll have a go, would be my advice. If you don't get it first time, use the second shot. The other little fact I want to present here is online testing. And this isn't available in every country around the world just yet, but they're rolling it out more and more. Online testing. I tried this out recently and I really loved it. My nearest exam center is over an hour's drive away through a lot of, well, that's on a good day, never mind in the traffic. I tested at home recently and I loved it. I could just test at home using my webcam in a quiet room, or you can do this in the workplace, of course, as well. That's something that you might want to look into as well. It's no extra cost, but it's more convenient for some people. If you live far away from a test center, you'll love that. Take a look. And resources. Where else do I go next? Take a look at the Microsoft Learning site. I've taken a lot of the information here from this presentation from the exam objective domain area. You can find that out and go back and look at that and have a look at other links and resources from there too. Virtual Academy, we've already called out. This is changing all the time. They are creating content every single day for this. Look back at the ones we've mentioned, but also look to some of the other content around on Virtual Academy as well. I've mentioned a few things as we went along. And last of all, if you want some advice on, or some information rather, on your career and which certifications to take next, or I've done 697, what should I do next? What's my pathway? What roadmaps are available for me? There's actually an app you can get. There's a short URL to that here, but you can get it in the store, in the Windows Store, and that will help you to plan your career pathway so that once you've done the 697, you can think, well, okay, I got to this level. I'm a Microsoft specialist in configuring Windows devices. What's next? Where should I go from here? So take a look at the app and it'll help you understand the pathways and the different variations on those routes, okay? So in conclusion, I hope you found this exam prep session for 697 useful. Join in the discussion on the Born to Learn forums if you want to discuss this with your peers and trainers and others, if you want to know more. But thank you very much for your time and good luck with your test. Thank you very much.